manner and in the same time throughout the country. When the central government, which represents the majority, has issued a decree, it must entrust the execution of its will to agents, over whom it frequently has no control, and whom it cannot perpetually direct. The townships, municipal bodies, and counties may therefore be looked upon as concealed breakwaters, which check or part the tide of popular excitement. If an oppressive law were passed, the liberties of the people would still be protected by the means by which that law would be put in execution. The majority cannot descend to the details and, as I will venture to style them, the puerilities of administrative tyranny. Nor does the people entertain that full consciousness of its authority which would prompt it to interfere in these matters. It knows the extent of its natural powers, but it is unacquainted with the increased resources which the art of government might furnish. This point deserves attention, for if a democratic republic similar to that of the United States were ever founded in a country where the power of a single individual had previously subsisted, and the effects of a centralized administration had sunk deep into the habits and the laws of the people, I do not hesitate to assert that in that country a more insufferable despotism would prevail than any which now exists in the monarchical states of Europe, or indeed than any which could be found on this side of the confines of Asia. The profession of the law in the United States serves to counterpoise the democracy. In visiting the Americans and in studying their laws, we perceive that the authority they have entrusted to members of the legal profession and the influence which these individuals exercise in the government is the most powerful existing security against the excesses of democracy. This effect seems to me to result from a general cause which it is useful to investigate, since it may produce analogous consequences elsewhere. The members of the legal profession have taken an important part in all the vicissitudes of political society in Europe during the last 500 years. At one time, they have been the instruments of those who were invested with political authority, and at another, they have succeeded in converting political authorities into their instrument. In the Middle Ages, they afforded a powerful support of the crown, and since that period, they have exerted themselves to the utmost to limit the royal prerogative. In England, they have contracted a close alliance with the aristocracy. In France, they have proved to be the most dangerous enemies of that class. It is my object to inquire whether, under all these circumstances, the members of the legal profession have been swayed by sudden and momentary impulses, or whether they have been impelled by principles which are inherent in their pursuits and which will always recur in history. I am incited to this investigation by reflecting that this particular class of men will most likely play a prominent part in the order of things to which the events of our time are giving birth. Men who have more especially devoted themselves to legal pursuits derive from those occupations certain habits of order, a taste for formalities, and a kind of instinctive regard for the regular connection of ideas, which naturally render them very hostile to the revolutionary spirit and the unreflecting passions of the multitude. The special information which lawyers derive from their studies ensures them a separate station in society, and they constitute a sort of privileged body in the scale of intelligence. This notion of their superiority perpetually recurs to them in the practice of their profession. They are the masters of a science which is necessary, but which is not very generally known. They serve as arbiters between the citizens, and the habit of directing the blind passions of parties in litigation to their purpose inspires them with a certain contempt for the judgment of the multitude. To this, it may be added that they naturally constitute a body, not by any previous understanding or by an agreement which directs them to a common end. But the analogy of their studies and the uniformity of their proceedings connect their minds together, as much as a common interest could combine their endeavors. A portion of the tastes and of the habits of the aristocracy may consequently be discovered in the characters of men in the profession of the law. They participate in the same instinctive love of order and of formalities, and they entertain the same repugnance to the actions of the multitude, and the same secret contempt of the government of the people. I do not mean to say that the natural propensities of lawyers are sufficiently strong to sway them irresistibly, for they, like most other men, are governed by their private interests and the advantages of the moment. In a state of society in which the members of the legal profession are prevented from holding that rank in the political world which they enjoy in private life, we may rest assured that they will be the foremost agents of revolution. But it must then be inquired whether the cause which induces them to innovate and to destroy is accidental, or whether it belongs to some lasting purpose which they entertain. It is true that lawyers mainly contributed to the overthrow of the French monarchy in 1789, but it remains to be seen whether they acted thus because they had studied the laws or because they were prohibited from cooperating in the work of legislation. 500 years ago, the English nobles headed the people and spoke in its name. At the present time, the aristocracy supports the throne and defends the royal prerogative. But aristocracy has, notwithstanding this, its peculiar instincts and propensities. We must be careful not to confound isolated members of a body with the body itself. In all free governments, of whatsoever form they may be, members of the legal profession will be found at the head of all parties. The same remark is also applicable to the aristocracy. For almost all the democratic convulsions which have agitated the world have been directed by nobles. A privileged body can never satisfy the ambition of all its members. It has always more talents and more passions to content and to employ than it can find places, so that a considerable number of individuals are usually to be met with who are inclined to attack those very privileges which they find it impossible to turn to their own account. I do not then assert that all the members of the legal profession are at all times the friends of order and the opponents of innovation, but merely that most of them usually are so. In a community in which lawyers are allowed to occupy, without opposition, that high station which naturally belongs to them, their general spirit will be eminently conservative and anti-democratic. When an aristocracy excludes the leaders of that profession from its ranks, it excites enemies which are the most formidable to its security, as they are independent of the nobility by their industrious pursuits, and they feel themselves to be its equal in point of intelligence, although they enjoy less opulence and less power. But whenever an aristocracy consents to impart some of its privileges to these same individuals, the two classes coalesce very readily and assume, as it were, the consistency of a single order of family interests. I am, in like manner, inclined to believe that a monarch will always be able to convert legal practitioners into the most serviceable instruments of his authority. There is a far greater affinity between this class of individuals and the executive power than there is between them and the people. Just as there is a greater natural affinity between the nobles and the monarch than between the nobles and the people, although the higher orders of society have occasionally resisted the prerogative of the crown in concert with the lower classes. Lawyers are attached to public order beyond every other consideration, and the best security of public order is authority. It must not be forgotten that, if they prize the free institutions of their country much, they nevertheless value the legality of those institutions far more. They are less afraid of tyranny than of arbitrary power. And provided that the legislature is taken upon itself to deprive men of their independence, they are not dissatisfied. I am therefore convinced that the prince who, in presence of an encroaching democracy, should endeavor to impair the judicial authority in his dominions and to diminish the political influence of lawyers, would commit a great mistake. He would let slip the substance of authority to grasp at the shadow. He would act more wisely in introducing men connected with the law into the government. And if he entrusted them with the conduct of a despotic power, bearing some marks of violence, that power would most likely assume the external features of justice and of legality in their hands. The government of democracy is favorable to the political power of lawyers. For when the wealthy, the noble, and the prince are excluded from the government, they are sure to occupy the highest stations in their own right, as it were, since they are the only men of information and sagacity beyond the sphere of the people, who can be the object of the popular choice. If, then, they are led by their tastes to combine with the aristocracy and to support the crown, they are naturally brought into contact with the people by their interests. They like the government of democracy, without participating in its propensities and without imitating its weaknesses, whence they derive a twofold authority, from it and over it. The people in democratic states does not mistrust the members of the legal profession, because it is well known that they are interested in serving the popular cause, and it listens to them without irritation, because it does not attribute to them any sinister designs. The object of lawyers is not indeed to overthrow the institutions of democracy, but they constantly endeavor to give it an impulse which diverts it from its real tendency by means which are foreign to its nature. Lawyers belong to the people by birth and interest, to the aristocracy by habit and by taste, and they may be looked upon as the natural bond and connecting link of the two great classes of society. The profession of the law is the only aristocratic element which can be amalgamated without violence with the natural elements of democracy, and which can be advantageously and permanently combined with them. I am not unacquainted with the defects which are inherent in the character of that body of men, but without this admixture of lawyer-like sobriety with the democratic principle, I question whether democratic institutions could long be maintained, and I cannot believe that a republic could subsist at the present time if the influence of lawyers in public business did not increase in proportion to the power of the people. This aristocratic character, which I hold to be common to the legal profession, is much more distinctly marked in the United States and in England than in any other country. This proceeds not only from the legal studies of the English and American lawyers, but from the nature of the legislation and the position which those persons occupy in the two countries. The English and the Americans have retained the law of precedence, that is to say, they continue to found their legal opinions and the decisions of their courts upon the opinions and decisions of their forefathers. In the mind of an English or American lawyer, a taste and a reverence for what is old is almost always united to a love of regular and lawful proceedings. This predisposition has another effect upon the character of the legal profession and upon the general course of society. The English and American lawyers investigate what has been done. The French advocate inquires what should have been done. The former produce precedents, the latter reasons. A French observer is surprised to hear how often an English or an American lawyer quotes the opinions of others, and how little he alludes to his own, whilst the reverse occurs in France. There, the most trifling litigation is never conducted without the introduction of an entire system of ideas peculiar to the counsel employed, and the fundamental principles of law are discussed in order to obtain a perch of land by the decision of the court. This abnegation of his own opinion and this implicit deference to the opinion of his forefathers, which are common to the English and American lawyer, this subjection of thought which he is obliged to profess, necessarily give him more timid habits and more sluggish inclinations in England and America than in France. The French codes are often difficult of comprehension, but they can be read by everyone. Nothing, on the other hand, can be more impenetrable to the uninitiated than a legislation founded upon precedents. The indispensable want of legal assistance which is felt in England and in the United States, and the high opinion which is generally entertained of the ability of the legal profession, tend to separate it more and more from the people and to place it in a distinct class. The French lawyer is simply a man extensively acquainted with the statutes of his country, but the English or American lawyer resembles the hierophants of Egypt, for, like them, he is the sole interpreter of an occult science. The station which lawyers occupy in England and America exercises no less an influence upon their habits and their opinions. The English aristocracy, which has taken care to attract to its sphere whatever is at all analogous to itself, has conferred a high degree of importance and of authority upon the members of the legal profession. In English society, lawyers do not occupy the first rank, but they are contented with the station assigned to them. They constitute, as it were, the younger branch of the English aristocracy, and they are attached to their elder brothers, although they do not enjoy all their privileges. The English lawyers consequently mingled the taste and the ideas of the aristocratic circles in which they move with the aristocratic interests of their profession. And indeed, the lawyer-like character which I am endeavoring to depict is most distinctly to be met with in England. There, laws are esteemed not so much because they are good as because they are old. And if it be necessary to modify them in any respect, or to adapt them the changes which time operates in society, recourse is had to the most inconceivable contrivances in order to uphold the traditionary fabric, and to maintain that nothing has been done which does not square with the intentions and complete the labors of former generations. The very individuals who conduct these changes disclaim all intention of innovation, and they had rather resort to absurd expedients than plead guilty to so great a crime. This spirit appertains more especially to the English lawyers. They seem indifferent to the real meaning of what they treat, and they direct all their attention to the letter, seeming inclined to infringe the rules of common sense and of humanity rather than to swerve one title from the law. The English legislation may be compared to the stock of an old tree, upon which lawyers have engrafted the most various shoots, with the hope that, although their fruits may differ, their foliage at least will be confounded with the venerable trunk which supports them all. In America, there are no nobles or men of letters, and the people is apt to mistrust the wealthy. Lawyers consequently form the highest political class and the most cultivated circle of society. They have therefore nothing to gain by innovation, which adds a conservative interest to their natural taste for public order. If I were asked where I place the American aristocracy, I should reply without hesitation that it is not composed of the rich, who are united together by no common tie, but that it occupies the judicial bench and the bar. The more we reflect upon all that occurs in the United States, the more shall we be persuaded that the lawyers as a body form the most powerful, if not the only, counterpoise to the democratic element. In that country we perceive how eminently the legal profession is qualified by its powers, and even by its defects, to neutralize the vices which are inherent in popular government. When the American people is intoxicated by passion or carried away by the impetuosity of its ideas, it is checked and stopped by the almost invisible influence of its legal counselors, who secretly oppose their aristocratic propensities to its democratic instincts, their superstitious attachment to what is antique to its love of novelty, their narrow views to its immense designs, and their habitual procrastination to its ardent impatience. The courts of justice are the most visible organs by which the legal profession is enabled to control the democracy. The judge is a lawyer who, independently of the taste for regularity and order which he has contracted in the study of legislation, derives an additional love of stability from his own inalienable functions. His legal attainments have already raised him to a distinguished rank amongst his fellow citizens. His political power completes the distinction of his station and gives him the inclinations natural to privileged classes. Armed with the power of declaring the laws to be unconstitutional, the American magistrate perpetually interferes in political affairs. He cannot force the people to make laws, but at least he can oblige it not to disobey its own enactments, or to act inconsistently with its own principles. I am aware that a secret tendency to diminish the judicial power exists in the United States, and by most of the constitutions of the several states, the government can, upon the demand of the two houses of the legislature, remove the judges from their station. By some other constitutions, the members of the tribunals are elected, and they are even subjected to frequent re-elections. I venture to predict that these innovations will sooner or later be attended with fatal consequences, and that it will be found out at some future period that the attack which is made upon the judicial power has affected the democratic republic itself. It must not, however, be supposed that the legal spirit of which I have been speaking has been confined in the United States to the courts of justice. It extends far beyond them. As the lawyers constitute the only enlightened class which the people does not mistrust, they are naturally called upon to occupy most of the public stations. They fill the legislative assemblies, and they conduct the administration. They consequently exercise a powerful influence upon the formation of the law, and upon its execution. The lawyers are, however, obliged to yield to the current public opinion, which is too strong for them to resist it. But it is easy to find indications of what their conduct would be if they were free to act as they choose. The Americans, who have made such copious innovations in their political legislation, have introduced very sparing alterations in their civil laws, and that with great difficulty, although those laws are frequently repugnant to their social condition. The reason of this is that in matters of civil law, the majority is obliged to defer to the authority of the legal profession, and that the American lawyers are disinclined to innovate when they are left to their own choice. It is curious for a Frenchman, accustomed to a very different state of things, to hear the perpetual complaints which are made in the United States against the stationary propensities of legal men and their prejudices in favor of existing institutions. The influence of the legal habits which are common in America extends beyond the limits I have just pointed out. Scarcely any question arises in the United States which does not become, sooner or later, a subject of judicial debate. Hence, all parties are obliged to borrow the ideas and even the language usual in judicial proceedings in their daily controversies. As most public men are or have been legal practitioners, they introduce the customs and technicalities of their profession into the affairs of the country. The jury extends this habitude to all classes. The language of the law thus becomes, in some measure, a vulgar tongue. The spirit of the law, which is produced in the schools and courts of justice, gradually penetrates beyond their walls into the bosom of society, where it descends to the lowest classes, so that the whole people contracts the habits and the tastes of the magistrate. The lawyers of the United States form a party which is but little feared and scarcely perceived, which has no badge peculiar to itself, which adapts itself with great flexibility to the exigencies of the time, and accommodates itself to all the movements of the social body. But this party extends over the whole community, and it penetrates into all classes of society. It acts upon the country imperceptibly, but it finally fashions it to suit its purposes. Trial by jury in the United States considered as a political institution. Since I have been led by my subject to recur to the administration of justice in the United States, I will not pass over this point without adverting to the institution of the jury. Trial by jury may be considered in two separate points of view, as a judicial and as a political institution. If it entered into my present purpose to inquire how far trial by jury, more especially in civil cases, contributes to ensure the best administration of justice, I admit that its utility might be contested. As the jury was first introduced at a time when society was in an uncivilized state, and when courts of justice were merely called upon to decide on the evidence of facts, it is not an easy task to adapt it to the wants of a highly civilized community when the mutual relations of men are multiplied to a surprising extent and have assumed the enlightened and intellectual character of the age. Author's note: the investigation of trial by jury as a judicial institution and the appreciation of its effects in the United States, together with the advantages the Americans have derived from it, would suffice to form a book, and a book upon a very useful and curious subject. The state of Louisiana would in particular afford the curious phenomenon of a French and English legislation, as well as a French and English population, which are gradually combining with each other. My present object is to consider the jury as a political institution, and any other course would divert me from my subject. Of trial by jury, considered as a judicial institution, I shall here say but very few words. When the English adopted trial by jury, they were a semi-barbarous people. They are become, in course of time, one of the most enlightened nations on the earth, and their attachment to this institution seems to have increased with their increasing cultivation. They soon spread beyond their insular boundaries to every corner of the habitable globe. Some have formed colonies, others independent states. The mother country has maintained its monarchical constitution. Many of its offspring have founded powerful republics. But wherever the English have been, they have boasted of the privilege of trial by jury. Author's note: all the English and American jurists are unanimous upon this head. Mr. Story, judge of the Supreme Court of the United States, speaks in his Treatise on the Federal Constitution of the advantages of trial by jury in civil cases. The inestimable privilege of a trial by jury in civil cases, a privilege scarcely inferior to that in criminal cases, which is counted by all persons to be essential to political and civil liberty. They have established it, or hastened to re-establish it, in all their settlements. A judicial institution, which obtains the suffrages of a great people for so long a series of ages, which is zealously renewed at every epoch of civilization, in all climates of the earth and under every form of human government, cannot be contrary to the spirit of justice. Author's note: if it were our province to point out the utility of the jury as a judicial institution in this place, much might be said, and the following arguments might be brought forward amongst others. By introducing the jury into the business of the courts, you are enabled to diminish the number of judges, which is a very great advantage. When judges are very numerous, death is perpetually thinning the ranks of the judicial functionaries and laying places vacant for newcomers. The ambition of the magistrates is therefore continually excited, and they are naturally made dependent upon the will of the majority, or the individual who fills up the vacant appointments. The officers of the court then rise like the officers of an army. This state of things is entirely contrary to the sound administration of justice and to the intentions of the legislator. The office of a judge is made inalienable in order that he may remain independent. But of what advantage is it that his independence should be protected if he be tempted to sacrifice it of his own accord? When judges are very numerous, many of them must necessarily be incapable of performing their important duties, for a great magistrate is a man of no common powers. And I am inclined to believe that a half-enlightened tribunal is the worst of all instruments for attaining those objects which it is the purpose of the courts of justice to accomplish. For my own part, I had rather submit the decision of a case to ignorant jurors directed by a skillful judge than to judges, a majority of whom are imperfectly acquainted with jurisprudence and with the laws. I turn, however, from this part of the subject. To look upon the jury as a mere judicial institution is to confine our attention to a very narrow view of it. For however great its influence may be upon the decisions of the law courts, that influence is very subordinate to the powerful effects which it produces on the destinies of the community at large. The jury is, above all, a political institution, and it must be regarded in this light in order to be duly appreciated. By the jury, I mean a certain number of citizens chosen indiscriminately and invested with the temporary right of judging. Trial by jury, as applied to the repression of crime, appears to me to introduce an eminently republican element into the government upon the following grounds. The institution of the jury may be aristocratic or democratic, according to the class of society from which the jurors are selected. But it always preserves its republican character, inasmuch as it places the real direction of society in the hands of the governed, or a proportion of the governed, instead of leaving it under the authority of the government. Force is never more than a transient element of success, and after force comes the notion of right. A government which should only be able to crush its enemies upon a field of battle would very soon be destroyed. The true sanction of political laws is to be found in penal legislation, and if that sanction be wanting, the law will sooner or later lose its cogency. He who punishes infractions of the law is therefore the real master of society. Now the institution of the jury raises the people itself, or at least a class of citizens, to the bench of judicial authority. The institution of the jury consequently invests the people, or that class of citizens, with the direction of society. Author's note: an important remark must, however, be made. Trial by jury does unquestionably invest the people with a general control over the actions of citizens, but it does not furnish means of exercising this control in all cases, or with an absolute authority. When an absolute monarch has the right of trying offenses by his representatives, the fate of the prisoner is, as it were, decided beforehand. But even if the people were predisposed to convict, the composition and the non-responsibility of the jury would still afford some chances favorable to the protection of innocence. In England, the jury is returned from the aristocratic portion of the nation. The aristocracy makes the laws, applies the laws, and punishes all infractions of the laws. Everything is established upon a consistent footing, and England may with truth be said to constitute an aristocratic republic. In the United States, the same system is applied to the whole people. Every American citizen is qualified to be an elector, a juror, and is eligible to office. See Appendix Q. The system of the jury, as it is understood in America, appears to me to be as direct and as extreme a consequence of the sovereignty of the people as universal suffrage. These institutions are two instruments of equal power, which contribute to the supremacy of the majority. All the sovereigns who have chosen to govern by their own authority and to direct society instead of obeying its directions have destroyed or enfeebled the institution of the jury. The monarchs of the House of Tudor sent to prison jurors who refused to convict, and Napoleon caused them to be returned by his agents. However clear most of these truths may seem to be, they do not command universal assent, and in France, at least, the institution of trial by jury is still very imperfectly understood. If the question arises as to the proper qualification of jurors, it is confined to a discussion of the intelligence and knowledge of the citizens who may be returned, as if the jury was merely a judicial institution. This appears to me to be the least part of the subject. The jury is preeminently a political institution. It must be regarded as one form of the sovereignty of the people. When that sovereignty is repudiated, it must be rejected, or it must be adapted to the laws by which that sovereignty is established. The jury is that portion of the nation to which the execution of the laws is entrusted, as the Houses of Parliament constitute that part of the nation which makes the laws. And in order that society may be governed with consistency and uniformity, the list of citizens qualified to serve on juries must increase and diminish with the list of electors. This I hold to be the point of view most worthy of the attention of the legislator, and all that remains is merely accessory. I am so entirely convinced that the jury is preeminently a political institution that I still consider it in this light when it is applied in civil causes. Laws are always unstable unless they are founded upon the manners of a nation. Manners are the only durable and resisting power in a people. When the jury is reserved for criminal offenses, the people only witness its occasional action in certain particular cases. The ordinary course of life goes on without its interference, and it is considered as an instrument, but not as the only instrument of obtaining justice. This is true a fortiori when the jury is only applied to certain criminal causes. When, on the contrary, the influence of the jury is extended to civil cases, its application is constantly palpable. It affects all the interests of the community. Everyone cooperates in its work. It thus penetrates into all the usages of life. It fashions the human mind to its peculiar forms and is gradually associated with the idea of justice itself. The institution of the jury, if confined to criminal causes, is always in danger, but when once it is introduced into civil proceedings, it defies the aggressions of time and of man. If it had been as easy to remove the jury from the manners as from the laws of England, it would have perished under Henry VIII and Elizabeth, and the civil jury did in reality at that period save the liberties of the country. In whatever manner the jury be applied, it cannot fail to exercise a powerful influence upon the national character. But this influence is prodigiously increased when it is introduced into civil causes. The jury, and more especially the jury in civil cases, serves to communicate the spirit of the judges to the minds of all the citizens. And this spirit, with the habits which attend it, is the soundest preparation for free institutions. It imbues all classes with the respect for the thing judged and with the notion of right. If these two elements be removed, the love of independence is reduced to a mere destructive passion. It teaches men to practice equity. Every man learns to judge his neighbor as he would himself be judged. And this is especially true of the jury in civil causes. For, whilst the number of persons who have reason to apprehend a criminal prosecution is small, everyone is liable to have a civil action brought against him. The jury teaches every man not to recoil before the responsibility of his own actions, and impresses him with that manly confidence without which political virtue cannot exist. It invests each citizen with a kind of magistracy. It makes them all feel the duties which they are bound to discharge towards society and the part which they take in the government. By obliging men to turn their attention to affairs which are not exclusively their own, it rubs off that individual egotism which is the rust of society. The jury contributes most powerfully to form the judgment and to increase the natural intelligence of a people, and this is, in my opinion, its greatest advantage. It may be regarded as a gratuitous public school ever open, in which every juror learns to exercise his rights, enter into daily communication with the most learned and enlightened members of the upper classes, and becomes practically acquainted with the laws of his country, which are brought within the reach of his capacity by the efforts of the bar, the advice of the judge, and even by the passions of the parties. I think that the practical intelligence and political good sense of the Americans are mainly attributable to the long use which they have made of the jury in civil causes. I do not know whether the jury is useful to those who are in litigation, but I am certain it is highly beneficial to those who decide the litigation, and I look upon it as one of the most efficacious means for the education of the people which society can employ. What I have hitherto said applies to all nations. But the remark I am now about to make is peculiar to the Americans and to democratic peoples. I have already observed that in democracies the members of the legal profession and the magistrates constitute the only aristocratic body which can check the irregularities of the people. This aristocracy is invested with no physical power, but it exercises its conservative influence on the minds of men, and the most abundant sources of its authority is the institution of the civil jury. In criminal causes, when society is armed against a single individual, the jury is apt to look upon the judge as a passive instrument of social power and to mistrust his advice. Moreover, criminal causes are entirely founded upon the evidence of facts which common sense can readily appreciate. Upon this ground, the judge and the jury are equal. Such, however, is not the case in civil causes. Then the judge appears as a disinterested arbiter between the conflicting passions of the parties. The jurors look upon him with confidence and listen to him with respect, for in this instance their intelligence is completely under the control of his learning. It is the judge who sums up the various arguments with which their memory has been wearied out, and who guides them through the devious course of the proceedings. He points their attention to the exact question of fact which they are called upon to solve, and he puts the answer to the question of law into their mouths. His influence upon their verdict is almost unlimited. If I am called upon to explain why I am but little moved by the arguments derived from the ignorance of jurors in civil causes, I reply that in these proceedings, whenever the questions to be solved is not a mere question of fact, the jury has only the semblance of a judicial body. The jury sanctions the decision of the judge. They, by the authority of society which they represent, and he, by that of reason and of law. See Appendix R. In England and in America, the judges exercise an influence upon criminal trials which the French judges have never possessed. The reason of this difference may be easily discovered. The English and American magistrates establish their authority in civil causes, and only transfer it afterwards to tribunals of another kind, where that authority was not acquired. In some cases, and they are frequently the most important ones, the American judges have the right of deciding causes alone. Author's note: the federal judges decide upon their own authority almost all the questions most important to the country. Upon these occasions, they are accidentally placed in the position which the French judges habitually occupy, but they are invested with far more power than the latter. They are still surrounded by the reminiscence of the jury, and their judgment has almost as much authority as the voice of the community at large, represented by that institution. Their influence extends beyond the limits of the courts. In the recreations of private life, as well as in the turmoil of public business, abroad and in the legislative assemblies, the American judge is constantly surrounded by men who are accustomed to regard his intelligence as superior to their own. And after having exercised his power in the decision of causes, he continues to influence the habits of thought and the characters of the individuals who took part in his judgment. The jury, then, which seems to restrict the right of magistracy, does in reality consolidate its power, and in no country are the judges so powerful as there, where the people partake their privileges. It is more especially by means of the jury in civil causes that the American magistrates imbue all classes of society with the spirit of their profession. Thus the jury, which is the most energetic means of making the people rule, is also the most efficacious means of teaching it to rule well. Chapter 17. Principal Causes Maintaining the Democratic Republic. A democratic republic subsists in the United States, and the principal object of this book has been to account for the fact of its existence. Several of the causes which contribute to maintain the institutions of America have been involuntarily passed by or only hinted at as I was borne along by my subject. Others I have been unable to discuss, and those on which I have dwelt most are, as it were, buried in the details of the former parts of this work. I think, therefore, that before I proceed to speak of the future, I cannot do better than collect with a small compass the reasons which best explain the present. In this retrospective chapter, I shall be succinct, for I shall take care to remind the reader very summarily of what he already knows. And I shall only select the most prominent of those facts which I have not yet pointed out. All the causes which contribute to the maintenance of the Democratic Republic in the United States are reducible to three heads. 1. The peculiar and accidental situation in which Providence has placed the Americans. 2. The laws. And 3. The manners and customs of the people. Accidental or providential causes which contribute to the maintenance of the Democratic Republic in the United States. 1,000 circumstances, independent of the will of man, concur to facilitate the maintenance of a democratic republic in the United States. Some of these peculiarities are known. The others may easily be pointed out, but I shall confine myself to the most prominent amongst them. The Americans have no neighbors, and consequently they have no great wars or financial crises or inroads or conquest to dread. They require neither great taxes nor great armies nor great generals. And they have nothing to fear from a scourge which is more formidable to republics than all these evils combined, namely, military glory. It is impossible to deny the inconceivable influence which military glory exercises upon the spirit of a nation. General Jackson, whom the Americans have twice elected to the head of their government, is a man of violent temper and mediocre talents. No one circumstance in the whole course of his career ever proved that he is qualified to govern a free people. And indeed, the majority of the enlightened classes of the Union has always been opposed to him. But he was raised to the presidency, and has been maintained in that lofty position solely by the recollection of a victory which he gained 20 years ago under the walls of New Orleans, a victory which was, however, a very ordinary achievement, and which could only be remembered in a country where battles are rare. Now the people, which is thus carried away by the illusions of glory, is unquestionably the most cold and calculating, the most unmilitary, if I may use the expression, and the most prosaic of all the peoples of the earth. America has no great capital city, whose influence is directly or indirectly felt over the whole extent of the country, which I hold to be one of the first causes of the maintenance of republican institutions in the United States. In cities, men cannot be prevented from concerting together, and from awakening a mutual excitement which prompts sudden and passionate resolutions. Cities may be looked upon as large assemblies, of which all the inhabitants are members. Their populace exercises a prodigious influence upon the magistrates, and frequently executes its own wishes without their intervention. Authors note, the United States have no metropolis, but they already contain several very large cities. Philadelphia reckoned 161,000 inhabitants, and New York 202,000 in the year 1830. The lower orders which inhabit these cities constitute a rabble even more formidable than the populace of European towns. They consist of freed blacks in the first place, who are condemned by the laws and by public opinion to a hereditary state of misery and degradation. They also contain a multitude of Europeans who have been driven to the shores of the New World by their misfortunes or their misconduct. And these men inoculate the United States with all our vices, without bringing with them any of those interests which counteract their baneful influence. As inhabitants of a country where they have no civil rights, they are ready to turn all the passions which agitate the community to their own advantage. Thus, within the last few months, serious riots have broken out in Philadelphia and in New York. Disturbances of this kind are unknown in the rest of the country, which is nowise alarmed by them, because the population of the cities has hitherto exercised neither power nor influence over the rural districts. Nevertheless, I look upon the size of certain American cities, and especially on the nature of their population, as a real danger which threatens the future security of the democratic republics of the New World. And I venture to predict that they will perish from this circumstance unless the government succeeds in creating an armed force which, whilst it remains under the control of the majority of the nation, will be independent of the town population and able to repress its excesses. To subject the provinces to the metropolis is therefore not only to place the destiny of the empire in the hands of a portion of the community, which may be reprobated as unjust, but to place it in the hands of a populace acting under its own impulses, which must be avoided as dangerous. The preponderance of capital cities is therefore a serious blow upon the representative system, and it exposes modern republics to the same defect as the republics of antiquity, which all perished from not having been acquainted with that form of government. It would be easy for me to adduce a great number of secondary causes which have contributed to establish, and which concur to maintain, the Democratic Republic of the United States. But I discern two principal circumstances amongst these favorable elements which I hasten to point out. I have already observed that the origin of the American settlements may be looked upon as the first and most efficacious cause to which the present prosperity of the United States may be attributed. The Americans had the chances of birth in their favor, and their forefathers imported that equality of conditions into the country whence the Democratic Republic has very naturally taken its rise. Nor was this all they did, for besides this republican condition of society, the early settler bequeathed to their descendants those customs, manners, and opinions which contribute most to the success of a republican form of government. When I reflect upon the consequences of this primary circumstance, methinks I see the destiny of America embodied in the first Puritan who landed on those shores, just as the human race was represented by the first man. The chief circumstance which has favored the establishment and the maintenance of a democratic republic in the United States is the nature of the territory which the American inhabit. Their ancestors gave them the love of equality and of freedom, but God Himself gave them the means of remaining equal and free by placing them upon a boundless continent which is open to their exertions. General prosperity is favorable to the stability of all governments, but more particularly of a democratic constitution, which depends upon the dispositions of the majority, and more particularly of that portion of the community which is most exposed to feel the pressure of want. When the people rules, it must be rendered happy, or it will overturn the state, and misery is apt to stimulate it to those excesses to which ambition rouses kings. The physical causes, independent of the laws which contribute to promote general prosperity, are more numerous in America than they have ever been in any other country in the world, at any other period of history. In the United States, not only is legislation democratic, but nature herself favors the cause of the people. In what part of human tradition can be found anything at all similar to that which is occurring under our eyes in North America? The celebrated communities of antiquity were all founded in the midst of hostile nations, which they were obliged to subjugate before they could flourish in their place. Even the moderns have found, in some parts of South America, vast regions inhabited by a people of inferior civilization, but which occupied and cultivated the soil. To found their new states, it was necessary to extirpate or to subdue a numerous population, until civilization has been made to blush for their success. But North America was only inhabited by wandering tribes, who took no thought of the natural riches of the soil, and that vast country was still, properly speaking, an empty continent, a desert land awaiting its inhabitants. Everything is extraordinary in America, the social condition of the inhabitants, as well as the laws. But the soil upon which these institutions are founded is more extraordinary than all the rest. When man was first placed upon the earth by the Creator, the earth was inexhaustible in its youth, but man was weak and ignorant. And when he had learned to explore the treasures which it contained, hosts of his fellow creatures covered its surface, and he was obliged to earn an asylum for repose and for freedom by the sword. At that same period, North America was discovered, as if it had been kept in reserve by the deity, and had just risen from beneath the waters of the deluge. That continent still presents, as it did in the primeval time, rivers which rise from never-failing sources, green and moist solitudes, and fields which the plowshare of the husbandman has never turned. In this state it is offered to man, not in the barbarous and isolated condition of the early ages, but to a being who is already in possession of the most potent secrets of the natural world, who is united to his fellow men and instructed by the experience of 50 centuries. At this very time, 13 millions of civilized Europeans are peaceably spreading over those fertile plains, with whose resources and whose extent they are not yet themselves accurately acquainted. 3,000 or 4,000 soldiers drive the wandering races of the aborigines before them. These are followed by the pioneers, who pierce the woods, scare off the beasts of prey, explore the courses of the inland streams, and make ready the triumphal procession of civilization across the waste. The favorable influence of the temporal prosperity of America upon the institutions of that country has been so often described by others, and adverted to by myself, that I shall not enlarge upon it beyond the addition of a few facts. An erroneous notion is generally entertained that the deserts of America are peopled by European emigrants, who annually disembark upon the coasts of the New World, whilst the American population increases and multiplies upon the soil which its forefathers tilled. The European settler, however, usually arrives in the United States without friends and sometimes without resources. In order to subsist, he is obliged to work for hire, and he rarely proceeds beyond that belt of industrious population which adjoins the ocean. The desert cannot be explored without capital or credit, and the body must be accustomed to the rigors of a new climate before it can be exposed to the chances of forest life. It is the Americans themselves who daily quit the spots which gave them birth to acquire extensive domains in a remote country. Thus the European leaves his cottage for the transatlantic shores, and the American, who is born on that very coast, plunges in his turn into the wilds of Central America. This double emigration is incessant. It begins in the remotest parts of Europe. It crosses the Atlantic Ocean and advances over the solitudes of the New World. Millions of men are marching at once towards the same horizon. Their language, their religion, their manners differ, their object is the same. The gifts of fortune are promised in the West, and to the West they bend their course. No event can be compared with this continuous removal of the human race, except perhaps those eruptions which preceded the fall of the Roman Empire. Then, as well as now, generations of men were impelled forwards in the same direction to meet and struggle on the same spot, but the designs of Providence were not the same. Then every newcomer was the harbinger of destruction and of death. Now every adventurer brings with him the elements of prosperity and of life. The future still conceals from us the ulterior consequences of this emigration of the Americans towards the West, but we can readily apprehend its more immediate results. As a portion of the inhabitants annually leave the states in which they were born, the population of these states increases very slowly, although they have long been established. Thus, in Connecticut, which only contains 59 inhabitants to the square mile, the population has not increased by more than one quarter in 40 years, whilst that of England has been augmented by one third in the lapse of the same period. The European emigrant always lands, therefore, in a country which is but half full, and where hands are in request. He becomes a workman in easy circumstances. His son goes to seek his fortune in unpeopled regions, and he becomes a rich landowner. The former amasses the capital which the latter invests, and the stranger, as well as the native, is unacquainted with want. The laws of the United States are extremely favorable to the division of property, but a cause which is more powerful than the laws prevents property from being divided to excess. Author's note: in New England, the estates are exceedingly small, but they are rarely subjected to further division. This is very perceptible in the states which are beginning to be thickly peopled. Massachusetts is the most populous part of the Union, but it contains only 80 inhabitants to the square mile, which is much less than in France, where 162 are reckoned to the same extent of country. But in Massachusetts, estates are very rarely divided. The eldest son takes the land, and the others go to seek their fortune in the desert. The law has abolished the rights of primogeniture, but circumstances have concurred to re-establish it under a form of which none can complain, and by which no just rights are impaired. A single fact will suffice to show the prodigious number of individuals who leave New England in this manner to settle themselves in the wilds. We were assured in 1830 that 36 of the members of Congress were born in the little state of Connecticut. The population of Connecticut, which constitutes only 1/43 part of that of the United States, thus furnished 1/8 of the whole body of representatives. The states of Connecticut, however, only sends 5 delegates to Congress, and the 31 others sit for the new western states. If these 31 individuals had remained in Connecticut, it is probable that instead of becoming rich landowners, they would have remained humble laborers, that they would have lived in obscurity without being able to rise into public life, and that, far from becoming useful members of the legislature, they might have been unruly citizens. These reflections do not escape the observation of the Americans any more than of ourselves. "It cannot be doubted," says Chancellor Kent in his Treatise on American Law, "that the division of landed estates must produce great evils when it is carried to such excess as that each parcel of land is insufficient to support a family. But these disadvantages have never been felt in the United States, and many generations must elapse before they can be felt. The extent of our inhabited territory, the abundance of adjacent land, and the continual stream of emigration flowing from the shores of the Atlantic towards the interior of the country suffice as yet, and will long suffice, to prevent the parceling out of estates." It is difficult to describe the rapacity with which the American rushes forward to secure the immense booty which fortune proffers to him. In the pursuit, he fearlessly braves the arrow of the Indian and the distempers of the forest. He is unimpressed by the silence of the woods. The approach of beasts of prey does not disturb him, for he is goaded onwards by a passion more intense than the love of life. Before him lies a boundless continent, and he urges onwards as if time pressed, and he was afraid of finding no room for his exertions. I have spoken of the emigration from the older states, but how shall I describe that which takes place from the more recent ones? 50 years have scarcely elapsed since that of Ohio was founded. The greater part of its inhabitants were not born within its confines. Its capital has only been built 30 years, and its territory still covered by an immense extent of uncultivated fields. Nevertheless, the population of Ohio is already proceeding westward, and most of the settlers who descend to the fertile savanna of Illinois are citizens of Ohio. These men left their first country to improve their condition. They quit their resting place to ameliorate it still more. Fortune awaits them everywhere, but happiness they cannot attain. The desire of prosperity is become an ardent and restless passion in their minds, which grows by what it gains. They early broke the ties which bound them to their natal earth, and they have contracted no fresh ones on their way. Emigration was at first necessary to them as a means of subsistence, and it soon becomes a sort of game of chance, which they pursue for the emotions it excites as much as for the gain it procures. Sometimes the progress of man is so rapid that the desert reappears behind him, the woods stoop to give him a passage, and spring up again when he is passed. It is not uncommon in crossing the new states of the West to meet with deserted dwellings in the midst of the wilds. The traveler frequently discovers the vestiges of a log house in the most solitary retreats, which bear witness to the power, and no less to the inconstancy of man. In these abandoned fields and over these ruins of a day, the primeval forest soon scatters a fresh vegetation, the beasts resume the haunts which were once their own, and nature covers the traces of man's path with branches and with flowers, which obliterate his evanescent track. I remember that, in crossing one of the woodland districts which still cover the state of New York, I reached the shores of a lake embosomed in forests coeval with the world. A small island, covered with woods whose thick foliage concealed its banks, rose from the center of the waters. Upon the shores of the lake, no object attested the presence of man except a column of smoke which might be seen on the horizon rising from the tops of the trees to the clouds, and seeming to hang from heaven rather than to be mounting to the sky. An Indian shallop was hauled up on the sand, which tempted me to visit the islet that had first attracted my attention, and in a few minutes I set foot upon its bank. The whole island formed one of those delicious solitudes of the New World which almost led civilized man to regret the haunts of the savage. A luxuriant vegetation bore witness to the incomparable fruitfulness of the soil. The deep silence, which is common to the wilds of North America, was only broken by the hoarse cooing of the wood pigeon and the tapping of the woodpecker upon the bark of trees. I was far from supposing that this spot had ever been inhabited, so completely did nature seem to be left to her own caprices. But when I reached the center of the island, I thought that I discovered some traces of man. I then proceeded to examine the surrounding objects with care, and I soon perceived that a European had undoubtedly been led to seek a refuge in this retreat. Yet what changes had taken place in the scene of his labors? The logs which he had hastily hewn to build himself a shed had sprouted afresh. The very props were intertwined with living verdure, and this cabin was transformed into a bower. In the midst of these shrubs a few stones were to be seen, blackened with fire and sprinkled with thin ashes. Here the hearth had no doubt been, and the chimney, in falling, had covered it with rubbish. I stood for some time in silent admiration of the exuberance of nature and the littleness of man. And when I was obliged to leave that enchanting solitude, I exclaimed with melancholy, "Are ruins, then, already here?" In Europe, we are wont to look upon a restless disposition, an unbounded desire of riches, and an excessive love of independence as propensities very formidable to society. Yet these are the very elements which ensure a long and peaceful duration to the republics of America. Without these unquiet passions, the population would collect in certain spots, and would soon be subject to wants like those of the old world, which it is difficult to satisfy. For such is the present good fortune of the new world, that the vices of its inhabitants are scarcely less favorable to society than their virtues. These circumstances exercise a great influence on the estimation in which